Okay, so tonight we begin the Minor Prophets. The Minor Prophets are a series of books that are exciting to teach, but are hard to get to. Because in order to really appreciate them, you have to have a certain body of knowledge of the Old Testament in order for those Minor Prophets to really come to life. Otherwise, they're just, you know, people read through them, they go, well, okay, and kind of. If you're doing like a read the Bible in a year program, you kind of hobble your way through that section and go, okay, I did it, but I don't necessarily know a whole lot of what it was about. But if you get the context, boy, it just really opens up. The difference between the major and the minor prophets, just to very quickly kind of cover this, is just word length. It's the major prophets wrote a lot. The minor prophets wrote a little. That's really the only difference. They're not major as in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel were better prophets than the Hoseas and the Joels and the Amoses. It's just simply word count. And so we finished Jeremiah, total of 52 chapters. We'll move into the minor prophets and you know, you have Hosea, which is kind of a longer minor prophet at 14 chapters. So there's just a significant difference in terms of word count. So that's the only real reason they're called the major and the minor prophets. The prophets are great, but in order to understand them, you've got to have that context. So the context to the prophets, whether it be the major or the minor prophets, is the national history of Israel, the geopolitical climate, to use kind of a more technical term, meaning what politically is going on in that area of geography, how are they interacting with the other nations around them, what is the religious environment of the time, are they, what are the sort of things they're struggling with? For example, you go to the book of Malachi. Idolatry is not an issue in Malachi's time, but corrupt apathy is. So when you read through Malachi, you're seeing people who are, they are professing to follow Jehovah. They would certainly say idols are wrong, but they just kind of are half-hearted about it, and there's problems there. Whereas Hosea and Amos, which will be the two first minor prophets that we'll look at, totally different religious environment. Idolatry is rampant. The nation is built off of idolatry and the worship of the golden calves at Dan and Bethel. So totally different religious climate. And so the writing is different accordingly. So in order to really appreciate these prophets, you've got to have that context to it. One of the great blessings of the prophets are almost all of them, with the exception of a couple like Joel is a good example of it, that we don't quite know exactly when Joel was written. But most of them will start out by saying, who wrote it? Who's the prophet? And the kings that were in power at the time that it was written. So you can just simply go, oh, okay, well, these are the guys who were in charge at the time this guy was speaking. So what was going on? And so you go back to Kings and Chronicles, which is the actual physical history chronicled of the kings. So that's an easy way to remember those two sets of books. First and Second Kings is about kings and kingdoms. First and Second Chronicles is the chronicling of those kingdoms. And so you can go look at those histories of the nations at that time period that those guys were kings and say, okay, that's what's going on, and we can have a better understanding because of it. Amos, I have this quote from Amos chapter 3 because I think it's indicative of what we really want to understand from the prophets. Amos will say to the people he's speaking to, surely the Lord Jehovah will do nothing except he reveal his secret unto his servants, the prophets. There is a pattern that we see in the Old Testament that God is always sending prophets ahead of time to warn the nation so that they have the opportunity to change and meet God's will. So the prophets are always forebearers of whatever the future holds, with the hope that people will listen to them. Ezekiel will be called the watchman of Israel. He says, look, you're a watchman. You stand up on the ramparts of the city. You blow the trumpet. The trumpet tells people an army's coming. Now, once you blow the trumpet, Ezekiel, the next part's up to the people. A smart guy will hear that trumpet and he's going to run because he says, ah, that's a warning and I'm going to head for the hills. A dumb guy is not going to listen to it and he gets what he gets. But Ezekiel, your job is to blow the trumpet. The prophets are alarmist by nature because there is an alarming time that they are preparing people for. Now, there are a couple of exceptions to that. Some of the prophets are writing during a time that, like Haggai, where there's restoration and God is primarily giving a hopeful message, be strong, be courageous, be brave, you can do this, God is with you. But most of the prophets exist during a time where things were not going well and God is sounding the alarm so that people could change. And that's a gift from God. And it's a pattern we actually see in God's character that is worth remembering. Even when Judas was going to betray Jesus, Jesus still gave Judas some opportunities to change his mind. Even then, he said, I know one of you is going to betray me. And if you remember, the apostles said, well, who would do that? And he says, the one who dips his hand, his bread with me in the bowl. And of course, that was Judas. And then even when Judas came up to him and he says, go and whatever you're going to do, do quickly. In other words, I know what you're going to do. If you're going to do it, do it. But Jesus was always warning people. He warned Peter. He warned Judas. The Old Testament is full of warnings so that you have a choice. Do you listen to the alarm of the watchman or not? So in order to understand these prophets, you have to have that rooting into the context of the world around you. So now as we look at these major and minor prophets, there are a lot of minor prophets. And so you always have a decision to make as a teacher. I could do this a couple of different ways. We could say, we're going to go verse by verse, line by line, with every minor, with every chapter in some of the minor prophets. If we do that, we could pick a handful of them and say, okay, we'll cover those, and it'll take us, 12, 13 weeks. I think we were in Jeremiah for 13 weeks. We could, if we went line by line through the minor prophets, we could pick a handful of them and do the same thing. If we did line by line, chapter by chapter for all of the minor prophets, we could be here for 40 weeks. And we could do that, but then if we're here 40 weeks, we're not somewhere else. So there's a trade-off with that. The third option is what I'm going with, which is we'll look at all of the minor prophets, and I'm going to do my very best to handle the difficult sections so that as you are personally reading, if you run into some section in, say, Hosea that's kind of tricky, I want to give you the tools for that so that you can understand it. I want to make sure that you have an overview of the books so that you can understand both the context of them, and as you're reading, you say, okay, well, this book is broken into roughly these sections. And so that you kind of have a roadmap for your own personal reading and study. And then I want you to have the general flow of the book. What's the general tenor and message that you could walk away from Amos? What would be the overall lesson and application for us? So my goal is to go through all of them, but to do so in a not a verse by verse way. There are pros and cons to both, as I said, but I think in this case, at least in this time in covering the minor prophets, that approach is the one that I think will pay the most dividends for where we're at right now. Okay. So if we look at the minor prophets and we just break them down, so put away the majors for a second, moving to the minors. The minor prophets, you can generally break them into three categories based off of who the message is to. Two of them, Hosea and Amos, and these will be the two that we cover first. Depending on how time goes, we may be able to dive into Hosea some tonight. They were written to the northern 10 tribes of Israel. So these 10 tribes were the ones that broke off when their civil war. We'll talk about that a little bit more. And Hosea and Amos are messengers to those two, those 10 tribes. The other 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are to Judah. So still Jews, still Israelites, but to the southern kingdom, which was made up of two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. This is the southern kingdom outlasted the northern kingdom. They had problems, but it took longer to manifest itself. And then one of the major differences with the southern kingdom is that they held within them the lineage of Christ. So the Davidic line is the line of ancestors that will eventually lead to Jesus being born from. So when you go to the book of Matthew and you read the genealogy of Jesus, what you see is that eventually it gets to David, and then all of the descendants from there come from David. And that was a promise of God, was that through the Davidic line would come the Christ. So Judah, having that Davidic line, will be protected in a way by God that the northern 10 tribes will not be, because God had promised Abraham, as well as Isaac, as well as Jacob, as well as David, that through that lineage would come the Christ. And so since the Christ is going to come through that lineage has to be preserved, even when the nation gets pretty rotten, and it will indeed get quite rotten. God will be preserving that national lineage because of the promises made to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and David. And then there's three books, Obadiah, Jonah, and Nahum. Jonah being probably the one you're most familiar with, that are written to other nations, pagan nations entirely. Jonah and Nahum are both written there to Nineveh. And like I said, that's the one that you're probably going to be the most familiar with, is Jonah and his journey to Nineveh that he didn't want to take. So anybody have any questions or comments or anything like that as we kind of look and break down the general minor prophet categories? Okay, so as I mentioned in Amos chapter 3, for the Lord God does nothing without revealing his secret to his servants, the prophets. We look at the way that things happen in nations, and it seems like a bit of a mystery to us. We as human beings look at what's going on in America at any given time, and everybody has their guess at what's going to happen next, right? In 2019, everybody had their guesses of what 2020 would be like. In fact, it's kind of funny to see some of the very positive outlooks that we all had at 2020. 2020 is going to be so clear. It's just so clear to me. It's going to be the best year ever. And, you know, we all had our guesses, and we were off the mark a little bit. It can still be your best year ever, but I doubt it was the way you envisioned it. And so that's always been the case. You know, people look at the way of politics and they try and envision how the future will unfold for their nation, and we're just really awful guessers. I mean, that's just the truth. We're really bad guessers. If you were really good at it, if somebody was really good at it and truly be able to understand the secrets of what's going on in nations and what's going to happen next, they really should just invest in the stock market and day trade, because they would know, oh, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. But we all know that, in fact, when people do that, when they guess at what will happen next, that's how you lose money. That's how you go broke, is trying to guess at what the future will hold. We're not good at it. And God even tells us that each day for us has enough trouble of its own. You are really not qualified to guess beyond a 24-hour period. So the future of a nation and why things are the way they are is really a secret. But in the book of Amos, God says that he did a special favor to the Jewish people, a special favor that he rarely offered to other nations, Nineveh being one of those rare exceptions, which is I will reveal ahead of time to you what's going to happen. I will tell you exactly how this is going to play out and exactly why it's going to play out. Now, for them, that was the sounding of the alarm that gave them a chance to repent, to change. For us, what it does is it lays out for us a better understanding of the inner workings of God's mind. When you look at the prophets, what you're really doing is you're beginning to understand just a little taste of why God interacts with nations the way that he does. Why does he cause some nations to rise and some nations to fall? What are the things that matter to God? Why does he allow people to be in power? And it turns out there are multiple reasons for all of these things. Sometimes he puts kings in power because the nation is, he wants to bless them with a righteous man because they as a nation have been righteous. Sometimes he puts good men in power because the nation's wicked, but he wants to give them a chance to have good leadership, see if they'll turn it around. Sometimes he gives a good nation bad leadership so that he can discipline them so that they'll become even better. Sometimes he'll give a bad nation bad leadership so that they can suffer the consequences of it. But what we begin to see as we look at the prophets is that God has a way of thinking about these things. It is not just flipping a coin with him. The inner workings of nations are based off of God's sovereign control and authority over all the nations of the earth. If you remember, Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That hasn't changed. God's statement in Romans 13 through Paul that all those who are in authority are there because he put them there is true today, just like it was in the first century and just like it was in the Old Testament. So what we get through the prophets is just kind of a little bit of a look under the hood. Why does it work this way? Why does God do the things that he does? So let's take a look at the context here of the prophets. And we'll, as we look at each individual prophet, we'll stop and kind of look at that, the context for that specific prophet. But for now, I just want you to look at some general principles you need to have in mind in order to understand the minor prophets. Under the first three kings of Israel, Saul, David, and Solomon, you have what is called the United Kingdom. Saul reigned for 40 years, David reigned for 40 years, and Solomon reigned for 40 years. It's really easy to remember, 40, 40, 40. During that time period, many problems, right? Saul wasn't a perfect king. David was a better king than Saul, but there was definitely unrest and civil unrest at various times, even from David's own household. But the kingdom is united. Solomon has his problems, but the kingdom is united. But then after the death of Solomon, and in part due to the sins of Solomon, that Solomon had accepted the idolatry of his foreign wives, God will create a division within the country. And that division will happen during the reign of Solomon's son, Rehoboam. And it will begin with what I will refer to as the presumption of Rehoboam. Now, if you go to 2 Kings chapter 12 and you read that account, Rehoboam becomes king and the people come to him and they ask him. They say, look, one thing we're just asking of you, lower our taxes. Solomon did a lot of great building projects during his lifetime, not the least of which was the temple. But these great building projects that he did cost money because money doesn't come from nowhere. And that money had to be collected in the form of taxation from the people. So Solomon, very wealthy and very prosperous economy, but actually also had high taxation. So Rehoboam comes king and the people say, will you lower the taxes? Rehoboam gets two pieces of advice. The older counselors, the ones that had served Solomon, said, look, the time has come to lower the taxes. If you do this, the people will love you. They'll follow you forever. And then he turns to his buddies, who are all his peers, and they say, you know, you ought to tell them, you don't tell me what to do. I'm the king around here. And if you thought my dad's taxes were bad, mine are going to be worse. And if you don't like it, I've got a gulag with your name on it. And so he listens to his buddies instead of the wise older counselors. And because of that, 10 of the tribes revolt under the leadership of Jeroboam. So if you look here, Rehoboam now becomes the king over the southern kingdom, and Jeroboam becomes the king over the northern kingdom. Now, Jeroboam, and I will mention this Jeroboam, the first Jeroboam, there's actually a second Jeroboam, and we'll refer to him as Jeroboam the second. This first one is often referred to as Jeroboam, son of Nebat. And so the way I remember him is I think of a guy taking a bat to your knee, because that's what he did to the nation. He went in there and he took a baseball bat and just absolutely crippled the nation by slamming them in the knee so they would limp along from that point forward. And what he did was to introduce a sin of idolatry. Now, he had some concerns. If you look here, here is the division between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom, much larger territory. They were much more prosperous. They had a lot going for them. Judah has less territory. They were less prosperous. More problems to start with, you would say. But at the beginning of Jeroboam's reign, he introduced, out of fear, because the one thing the southern kingdom had was Jerusalem. And at Jerusalem was the temple. And so his fear was the people will go down to Jerusalem. They'll go to worship God in Jerusalem. They'll say, isn't this wonderful? And eventually they'll go, you know, why we have this Jeroboam guy? We need to be United Kingdom again. And so he was afraid he would lose his position. So he set up an entirely new religious system. He set up two golden calves at Dan, which was the northern tip of the kingdom, and one at Bethel, which was the southern end of the kingdom, and told people, these are your gods that led you out of Egypt. And if that sounds familiar, it should, because there was another time they set up a golden calf, and it was out in the wilderness, and they got themselves in a lot of trouble with that too. So he set these up, and not only did he set up these two golden calves, but he set up a new priesthood. And he incentivized, he said, anybody who wants to be a priest can be a priest in this priesthood, which is different than what had existed before. Before this, what was the qualification to be a priest? What? Yep, you had to be from the tribe of Levi. So there was a certain group of people that were allowed and nobody else was. Well, he said, well, anybody who wants to be a priest, I'll let do that here. So he introduced it. The people accepted it, and it became an idolatrous sin that led them off for faster than the others. You can think of it like this. Both of these kingdoms are rotten. But the southern kingdom, it starts out a little less rotten. You think about if you pick up an apple and you never buy a bag of apples, and you pull an apple out and it's got kind of a bad spot on it. If it's just a little bad spot, you go, well, just cut it out and I can still eat it. It's still usable. But there comes a point where the rot is bad enough that you go, I can't use this at all. Well, both of them are rotten, but the southern one has only a little spot of rotten to start with. And the northern kingdom had a head start. So because of that head start, they will end up going off into captivity sooner than the southern kingdom did. They both have a lot of problems, but the northern one got a head start on doing it wrong, I guess you might say. So here, this is a picture, by the way, of Dan, and this is the actual location that they are pretty confident that golden calf in Dan was kept. If you look at the picture here, you see that kind of wooden structure. That is to represent the altar. When you think about an altar that they would sacrifice animals on, you wonder what it would look like. That's about how big it would have been, a fairly large structure. And then if you look up here at this platform, that is likely where the golden calf itself actually was. So there's quite a lot of historical evidence in Dan of the golden calf, which is kind of an interesting thing. Anybody have any questions? Is this all making sense? Anything? We good? Okay. So we mentioned this before, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but the promise to David that through his lineage would come the Christ led to the additional promise of the longevity and the preservation of the southern kingdom. In 1 Kings 11, it says, "To his son I'll give one tribe, that my servant David may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen for myself to put my name there." The promise to preserve the southern kingdom is based off of the promise to David, and God refers to it as, "I'll leave a lamp for David." And maybe you've heard those commercials for, I can't remember, is it Motel 6 or whoever, but "we'll leave a light on for you." It's that kind of idea. God says, I'll leave a lamp for David's lineage so that it's preserved, because we've got bigger plans in store than just the nation of Israel. We eventually want to bless all nations through the Christ. So that lamp, we're gonna keep that lamp lit until we get there. Which is another reason for the longevity of the southern kingdom versus the northern kingdom that will run into problems a lot sooner. Okay, so the first ones that we're going to look at will be Hosea and Amos. Now, so you can ignore that lower bar for now, because that's the southern kingdom. So for now, pay no attention to that. We're just going to look at the northern kingdom of Israel. In 2 Kings 17, it lays out the account of them going off into Assyrian captivity. The Assyrian nation, which was a powerful and very violent nation. They were a warring nation, unlike the nation of Babylon and some other nations that would come after them, the Medes and the Persians and whatnot. The Assyrians simply, their view was, we will be great and are by conquering other people. And that will also be our source of income. So all we're going to do is we're just going to swallow up smaller countries and take all their people, make them slaves, take all of their economy, their produce, everything, and make it ours. And we will just defeat them. And every time we start running low on money, it's like, how are we going to pay the soldiers? How about you go conquer another city and then you can pay the soldiers? And that's what they did. And they were brutal about it. The Assyrians invented the slave trade in mass of when they would capture a city, what they would do is they would put fish hooks in the lip or the nose or the ear of captives, and they would lead them off into captivity by a line, you think of like a fishing line, with a bunch of fish hooks all in the people's lips or ears, and a soldier would just drag them along, because if you've got a fish hook in your lip and a guy pulls on that line, you move. And so they would lead people into slavery. And they didn't give them second chances. They didn't say, oh, you can, like, well, Babylon will say, here, come and assimilate into Babylon, and we'll put you over here in a camp until you can kind of get used to the fact you're a Babylonian now. They didn't have any sort of mercy or patience or anything like that. They didn't offer an opportunity for surrender. They just simply said, you're a slave now, and you act up, we'll kill you. And they would go into a city. One of the things that they would do is when they would conquer a city, they would take all the bones, all the bodies of the people that they'd killed, they'd pile them into a big pile of skulls and bones right at the front of the city, so that anybody who went by would see a just massive pile of death and know Assyria's been here. So they're just brutal in every way. They will eventually, in 722 BC, conquer the northern kingdom, those 10 tribes. Now, that's the end result. That's where it's going. But as we mentioned, the prophets, their job is to warn. to sound the alarm. So the two prophets that we'll look at here of Hosea and Amos, who spoke to the northern kingdom, they speak before this time. And so they are primarily speaking during the time of Jeroboam, this Jeroboam right here, and we refer to him as Jeroboam the second. So Jeroboam the second is the king of Israel at the time that Amos and Hosea are both prophets, sounding the alarm that Assyrian captivity is coming. Now, if you look, and we do a little bit of, of math here, 722 BC is when they went into Assyrian captivity. Jeroboam's reign, let's just say the middle of his reign, so to speak, should be about, what is that? That's about 770. And so it's about 50 years. So when you're in the middle of Jeroboam's reign, you are 50 years away from total national annihilation. Well, 50 years isn't that long. 50 years is just really a drop in the bucket. That's not even the full lifetime of a person. You're not even really that far from the total destruction. But if you read over in 2 Kings 14, turn over in your Bible to 2 Kings 14 so that you can understand why the messages of Hosea and Amos in many respects were completely ignored. Now, one reason they were ignored is because of the wickedness of the nation. But the other was, look at the description of the reign of Jeroboam II. So 2 Kings 14, verse 23 through 29, it says, "In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah," so that's the southern kingdom, "Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years." So he has a good, long reign. "He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin." So he kept the golden calves. That's the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Remember, he's taken a bat to the knee. So he continues in those sins. But then look at verse 25. "He restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was of Gath-Hepher." That is the same Jonah, by the way, that you are familiar with. So he restores the border of Israel. Verse 26, "For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel, which was very bitter, for there was neither bond nor free, nor was there any helper for Israel. The Lord did not say that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash." And the rest, verse 28, "The rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did in his might, how he fought and how he recovered for Israel Damascus and Hamath, which had belonged to Judah, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Jeroboam slept with his fathers, even with the kings of Israel, and Zechariah, his son, became king in his place." If you read the history of Jeroboam, Jeroboam is economically a savior of the nation. He reigns for 41 years, gets this good, long, peaceful reign. He restores the border, so the nation's actually getting bigger. They're getting cities back that they haven't had under their control for a very long time. The people are enjoying a peace that they haven't enjoyed for a long time. And God knows it. God has even allowed it to happen, because verse 26 says the reason God let that happen is he saw the affliction of Israel. Up until Jeroboam the second, things have been getting worse and worse and worse, and the people had just been under so much affliction and heartache and difficulty that God offers them a reprieve. And so God is giving them a second chance to kind of get their feet under them. So economically, militarily, this is a good time. It's one of the best times in the northern kingdom's life. Spiritually, though, it's awful. Jeroboam II has continued with that idolatry that you find at Dan and Bethel. He's continued to do the evil in the sight of the Lord that we've seen with the previous kings before him. So spiritually, there's been no change whatsoever. So if you are somebody in the world during the time of Hosea and Amos, you're looking around and you're saying, this is the best we've ever had it. We've got prosperity like we haven't had in my lifetime. We've got peace on our borders. Our enemies are scared of us. They're leaving us alone. We're getting territory back. We're getting new cities that belong to us that we haven't had control over for a long time. We're more free now than I can ever remember. Everybody's got a job. They're living a good economic life. But spiritually, it's no less depraved than ever than it was before. This is from Lexham's Bible Dictionary. I think it's a good overall breakdown and summary of the Jeroboam II. He says he reigned 41 years from 786 to 746 BC, successful politically and militarily. He extended the boundaries of the northern kingdom, but did evil in the sight of God. Jeroboam's reign is contained only in 2 Kings 14, 23 through 29. So he is a success in all earthly things. That would be the way you would think of it. In all the things that worldly people care about, he's a winner. The economy's good. Politics are better than ever. Military's, Department of Defense is winning everything. We are doing really, really well. And it is in that culture and that moment of time that God sends both Hosea and Amos. Now, we'll look at Hosea first, but both of those men are preaching at the exact same time. Anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, so as we look at Hosea and Amos are fascinating guys because they're both preaching at the exact same time. But they are preaching vastly different styles. The message is the same because they're both sent by God. And the message is prepare, repent, change, or you're going into captivity. Very clear. But Hosea will preach it in a very different way than Amos will. Amos is a hard nose. He is a fire and brimstone. He's a John the Baptist kind of guy. He's a, you brood of vipers, you get out of here. Hosea's the opposite. Hosea is a man who has led a troubled life. He's had difficulties and heartaches, and it comes across in his preaching. Hosea's preaching, the book of Hosea covers lessons from Hosea that span about a 25-year time period. It would be like looking at the collective works of Hosea and summarized down to the most important messages over that 25-year time period. Much of it is actually written in a way that doesn't come across as poetry to us, but it would to a Jew. A Jew would view much of this as kind of like written in a long-form poetic style. But Hosea will have the theme of family at the heart of his message. And there will be two elements to that. And they're both things that we normally think of as such beautiful things. Marriage. When two people get married, that is a time of celebration. It's a time of joy. It's a wondrous thing. You know, they make their vows before friends and family and the Lord. They have their whole life ahead of them. And she loves him and he loves her. And it's just a wonderful celebratory time. And then the other is the time when you have children. And that, you think about the things that we send announcements out for. We send out wedding announcements and we send out birth announcements. And you're going to have children and isn't it going to be great and isn't it going to be wonderful? And all the hopes and dreams you have for your kids and what they'll do when they grow up and all these things. Well, Hosea's going to deal with those, but unfortunately, he's going to deal with it from the dark side. Because what is going to happen is with Hosea, if you go to the book of Hosea and you look in verse 2, the whole book begins with this. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord." So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. So what what God is going to do is he's going to put Hosea through life circumstances that are so painful that it's hard for us to really appreciate. He's going to marry a woman, and it's hard to tell, by the way, from the context, if she was already a harlot before he married her, or what God is saying is, you're going to marry a woman, and then she's going to break your heart. You know, when it starts out, it'll be fine. I actually lend myself towards the second one, because I think there's quite a few things in the context that point to the fact that Gomer, his wife, did not initially start out as a harlot, but became one. That she was a product of the culture of Israel at the time, and so she marries a godly man, and then there's all these restrictions of being married and yoked to somebody who has a very different value system than you, and that she goes out and chooses worldliness over and over and over again. And God's message to him will be, not only are you going to take a wife and have a troubled marriage and a troubled family, but then on top of that, that troubled marriage and troubled family, you're going to need to do something that requires a level of emotional heroics that most of us lack. You're going to need to accept her back. She's going to, at a certain point, need your help. After she's violated the marriage, after she's destroyed your heart, after she has done all these things to just hurt your family in every way, she's left you with these kids and nothing but heartache and broken pieces, and one day she's going to need you. And you're going to do the inconceivable. You're going to take her back. You're going to pay the debts that she owes her lovers. And you're going to try and rebuild that marriage, not because she's a good woman, not because she deserves it, but simply because of your love. And that theme is connected, God says, to his attitude towards Israel. He loved her and pulled her out of Egypt and saved her, and then all she's done is committed harlotry and gone to all these idols and all the wickedness. They violated the vows, and you have two choices at that point. You either put her away and end the covenant, and God says, I could do that, but I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to restore her to me, and I'm going to, through my love and compassion and mercy and righteousness, show love to a woman who has violated those vows. So for Homer, for Hosea, it's his wife Gomer, and for God, it's his wife, the nation of Israel. And so as we go through the book of Hosea, that's going to be the overwhelming theme, and we'll look at that in more detail next week. Does anybody have any comments or questions before we finish up? Yes. Yeah, so what Denise is saying, wouldn't it also make sense that she wasn't a harlot to start with, because that seems to kind of go against what God would tell us to do in terms of good advice? Yes, that's another piece of evidence that makes me lean that direction as well. So in Hosea 1 verse 2, when he says, go take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, that can mean one of two things. Either she is already a harlot, or you're going to take a wife and then she's going to go into harlotry and she's going to have children. You're not going to know whether those children are your children or somebody else's children. And I lend myself towards, yes, it was something she did after the marriage, not something that she had done before the marriage. And that, as you mentioned, I think that piece is one reason to think that way. Another is that when God talks about Israel, he talks about how they were clean to start with. And so he accepted them, but then they defiled themselves. And so if the shadow and the parallel matches, if Israel started out that way, it would make sense that Gomer started out that way too. Any other comments or questions? Okay, we'll shut down there. We'll pick up in Hosea, and we'll hope to get into Hosea, and we'll see how far we get through Hosea and Amos next week.